So today's agenda, we'll do the boilerplate stuff, the IP notes. Hello?
I can hear you.
Okay, sorry. I thought I heard someone trying to speak up. Okay, IP note, call notes, scribe selection, introductions and reminders. And then we're joined by guest expert Mike Lauder, who will talk about cryptographic accumulators. So I'm very excited about that. He's actually implemented them in different systems. And so, you know, it's a way to implement privacy-promoting credential verification, revocation, for example. And so he's had firsthand experience with this, so very excited to learn from him. Okay, let's move into the agenda now. IP note, anyone can participate in these calls. However, all substantive contributors to any CCG work items must be members of the CCG with full IPR agreement signed. Here is a link to join the CCG. And if you don't already, you need to ensure you have a W3 account, web account, and it's very simple to set up. All of this is for community groups free. And then to see the text of the contributor license agreement that's available at this location. So call notes, these minutes and an audio recording of everything said on the call are archived at the following location. Then pacing into IRC. We use IRC to cue speakers during the call as well as to take minutes. And the IRC, the address is included in the agenda that went out. So if you've not already joined IRC and you want to, just look at that meeting invitation for the IRC. All attendees should type present plus, the word present, and then the symbol plus, no space in between, to get your name on the attendee list in the transcript. You, if you're in IRC, you can see a few other people have done it already. And in IRC, type Q plus, the letter Q, symbol plus, to add yourself to the queue. And you can have an optional reminder, Q plus, to talk about something. So, and I'll show an IRC that looks like the following. So I'm going to clear myself from the queue, though. And if you're not an IRC, simply speak up and ask to be put on the queue. And please be brief so the rest of the queue can get a chance to chime in. You can always queue plus again. Okay, next part is scribe selection. Any volunteers to scribe?
Hey, this is Nate. I could do it this week.
Thank you so much, Nate. Okay, I'm recording. Oh, Nate did as well. Okay, next section of the call is the introductions and reintroductions. Anyone new to the call that would like to introduce themselves?
Hi, I was here last week, but I don't think I introduced myself. My name's Alan Third. I work for the Open University in the UK. I was working on blockchain credentials for quite a while now.
Hi, Alan. I'm sorry, I didn't get all of that. You said your name, you're Alan Third, and you're from where?
The Open University in the UK.
Great. Thank you for joining us.
My boss, John, spoke last week, but yeah, we've been doing blockchain credentials.
Yes, we're interested in hearing more about what you're doing as well, and we're thinking we will invite you guys to present for us at a future call. So thank you very much for joining.
Sure, everyone. Thank you.
Anyone else new to the call that would like to introduce themselves? Okay. Maybe we'll go ahead and get started with the main topic then, so we have extra time for that. So at this point, let me switch topics. And I'm going to let Mike present, and then, you know, we'll turn over for Q&A. Mike, do you mind? So I'll start by introducing him, and then I'll let him introduce himself for what he's recently been up to. But so Mike basically implemented cryptographic accumulators for the Sovereign system, which some of you are probably familiar with. So we're very fortunate to have him join us. And so I understand he's doing consulting now. But so with that, Mike, I'll turn it over to you, and just let me know whenever you want to sort of break for Q&A. Otherwise, I'll let you drive the this part.
Okay. Great. Thanks, Kim. I posted the link to my slides in the chat. Let me know if anyone is unable to access those. I believe I set the permissions correctly, so anybody can view them.
I can access them. Confirmed.
You can?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So on slide two, this is just a little bit about me. I am actually an independent consultant now. I no longer work for anyone or anything, which means the same reason for my slides. There's no template. There's nothing cool about them. They're just blank, just like me. So feel free to use these in any way, shape, or form. I can place these slides in the public domain for anyone to use. If you want to reuse these, I do not put any copyright on them. So with that, on slide three, I just wanted to – I'll try and say which slide I'm on before I move, if that helps. So on slide three, I'm just going to go over, for those of you that have no idea what cryptographic accumulators are, I will cover what they are, and then I'm going to dive into the crypto, but not a ton, but enough that you could understand them if you had to go read the math yourself using familiar protocols like RSA and Diffie-Hellman. And then I'm going to wrap it up by talking about how you could apply these to verifiable credentials. And away we go. So on slide four, so what a cryptographic accumulator is it's basically a very fast and secure way to prove SET membership, whether you're doing it inclusively or proving that something's not in there. And the three types that we have right now that that people are using in production, there's what we call a Merkle tree-based one. I'll go over each of these in detail as we go along. There's an RSA-based accumulator and an elliptic curve-based accumulator. And each one they use for various reasons, sizes, speed, setup, and a bunch of other things. But the main reason to use accumulators is the value of the accumulator is a fixed size. So with a Merkle tree, the root hash stays the same size. With an RSA, it's the same size of the modulus. An elliptic curve, it's the same size as the field elements. So, and the other great thing is you get constant time verification. So you can, regardless of how big the list size is, the verification time is constant. So that's great for the verifier. And we can use what are called zero knowledge proofs, and that we don't have to reveal which value we were testing to see if it was in there or not. You just know it's one of the 10 million or one of the 10 or however big the size of the accumulator is, however many elements are in there. You know it was one of those, but you don't know which one. And some of them allow you to even check the position. So if you wanted to say, was this value at the 10th position or the 100th, some of them even allow that. Those are some more advanced ones. But most of them, you don't even have to worry about that because all you care is whether it's in there or not. So on slide five, each accumulator has these parameters in it or is made up of these five elements. So there's the public parameters, and these are – these consist of like the generator, the modulus, if there is one, which there usually is, except in Merkle trees, an elliptic curve name or a hash algorithm. These are basically public parameters that everybody is entitled to see in order to create, update, and do proofs against the accumulator. Then there's what we call the elements, which are the values that are in the accumulator or will be in the accumulator. These are typically cryptographic integers. Cryptography doesn't deal with floating point numbers. Then there's the accumulator itself, the value, and that's just a fixed size. It's just an integer. And then there's what we call a witness. So a witness is a way to say, this is my value in the accumulator. So in a Merkle tree, it's your path from your leaf to the root. If it's an elliptic curve, it's just your value, your signature in it. If it's RSA, it's a prime number, and so on. And then we have what are called the list of the actual contained values, which is everything that's in there. So if you think about like a revocation list, you still have to maintain a list of all the values that are in it, but the advantage of adding an accumulator is you're not revealing which one you're proving is in there. Okay, so I'm on slide 6 now. So here's some basics of cryptography so that you can understand how this works. So I'm only going to throw two terms at you, and it's called, one is called the rule of exponents, which we learn in fifth grade. I know that because my 10-year-old and 11-year-old is learning that now in his fifth grade, or he was until school was canceled. And so with the rule of exponents, we have three rules just to remember. The first is if you have a common base, so in my first example, 2 to the 3 times 2 to the 7th, you add the exponents. The next one is if you're multiplying an exponent, so you have 2 to the 3 raised to the 7th, then you basically multiply the exponents. And we don't do division necessarily with exponents. You basically say it's a minus, and then you subtract the exponents. And so like 1 over 2 to the 2nd is the same as 2 to the minus 2. And then we get into what's called modular arithmetic, where everything is limited by what we call a modulus. So in the example of 2 mod 17, we can never have a number bigger than 17. This is called a field, a finite field. And it's the field limit modulus is 17. So the main thing to remember is that here is that every operation we do is mod 17. So if you say F field 17 or field 19, it's usually mod a prime, but it doesn't have to be. Sometimes they can be different than that. But then everything is implied to be mod the modulus. And to do a division, we don't really say you do a division. We do what's called a modular inverse, which is find a number multiplied by that number. When you do mod the modulus, would give you 1. So in the case of 2 to the minus 1 mod 17, to get 1, the inverse would be like 9, for example. 17 would equal 1 in that case. So in how modular arithmetic works, so now I'm on slide 7. We frequently describe it as clock arithmetic. So in this example, I said 53 mod 12 is equals 5. So think about you go around the clock, 53. So if you start at 0, which is the 12, you go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 12. Do it again until you don't go around completely, and then that's your answer. So that's how modular arithmetic works. Or you could think of it as the remainder after division. Okay? So in slide 8, I'm just kind of showing you some basic operations about how cryptography does things with modular arithmetic. You'll notice that, like I said, 5 plus 15 equals 3. It's implied that I'm doing mod 17 in this case. And same with subtraction, same with multiplication, and division. Remember, there's no division. We find a modular inverse. Okay? Most programming languages can do this. I know it can be done in Node and Python and Rust pretty easily. Okay, so on slide 9, the other basic to remember is that when we have a finite field, we usually like to find what's called a generator. A generator is basically a base. When you raise something to the exponent, that you'll be able to reach every other number less than the modulus. So in this case, 17, I want to find a generator that if I plug in every number less than 17, I can reach every other number. That's what constitutes a good, valid generator. And in cryptography, we use those everywhere. So it's not limited to 3 in this case as the only generator. Like 6 would probably be another good one. 11 would be another good one. There's nice fast rules to find a good generator, but just know that generators are important in cryptography, and we're going to use those in cryptographic accumulators. So now on slide 10, I'm just going to show you some basics on how this works using something you guys use every day. Maybe you don't realize you're using it every day, but you do. So on slide 11, there's this great protocol called Diffie-Hellman, which is for a key exchange. So when you connect to your bank or you connect to a server, you're almost always using Diffie-Hellman to exchange keys. And those keys are used just for a temporary session, and then they are forgotten. And the advantage of Diffie-Hellman is that anybody listening can't sniff and deduce what the actual key is in the end. So here's how Diffie-Hellman works on slide 11. You pick a big prime, like we'll say, you know, a couple hundred or thousand bits, and then you pick a good generator. That's what the G is. And then Alice is one party in this group, and Bob is the other. So they each generate a random number. So I'm going to designate that random number by little a and little b, and they keep those private. And then what Alice does is Alice uses the generator to exponentiate her little secret A mod N and computes a big A, and Bob does the same thing. Now moving on to slide 12, what they do is they send the big A and big B to each other, and then Alice takes Bob's value he sent and does the same thing, raises it to her little A mod N, and the rest of that equation, as you can see, following the rule of exponents, they both arrive at the exact same value, okay? That's a very basic computation, but it was a breakthrough at the time it was discovered. So moving on to slide 13, I'm going to show you how in RSA this kind of works. We do something similar, except that the modulus is not a prime number. It's called a coprime number, meaning it's the product of two primes, and when you do that, it makes finding a modular inverse really difficult unless you know what those prime numbers are. And so in RSA, the person who is generating their keys knows the primes, typically when they're generating their keys, and then they throw these away. But basically what you do with RSA is you find a modulus that's the product of two primes, and then you calculate a modular inverse of some prime number E. And then those are the public and private keys. And remember what I said about modular inverse is if you multiply them together, it's the same as 1. So that's how they basically divide each other in modular arithmetic. Okay. So encrypt says take the public key and encrypt it. And then decrypt says take the same thing but raise it to the actual inverse, which basically says we'll divide out E and you basically get the same thing back again. And in RSA, since it's a product of two primes, we don't know what the order is. So creating a generator is a little bit harder in RSA land, but it's still possible to do. It's just harder unless you have the prime numbers. But we still don't know what the order is because it's usually some big number. But with primes, we know exactly what the order is. Okay? Moving on to slide 14. So you saw whenever I take a generator and I exponentiate something to it and I do mod n, in zero-knowledge proofs and other areas, we call these Pedersen commitments. Basically, use what's called a commitment to prove that you know something and you can't change it. So think of like a horse betting. I want to bet on a horse. I just don't want to tell which horse I bet on unless it's the winner. But then I want to be able to prove I actually bet on that horse, right? And then there's the idea that you can actually have two separate generators, G1 and G2, still mod n, and you can generate a random number and the value you want to commit to, and you can create what's called a blinded commitment, and it has better hiding properties in that it is post-quantum resistant, meaning if there was a post-quantum computer and you had a blinded commitment floating out there in the wild, even a quantum computer wouldn't be able to reverse and find out what your value was, which is really cool. Okay, so on slide 15, with those basics in mind, let's discuss how the cryptographic accumulator works. So slide 16. The RSA accumulator is probably the easiest one to understand, so I'm going to walk you through how this would work. So again, remember I just said all accumulators have these basic properties. They have public parameters. So whoever is managing the accumulator creates an RSA modulus, which is the product of two primes, has to be a certain size. They have to pick what's called a hash to prime number. That's what H2P is. It basically says take some number and convert it to a prime number. And then there's also H, which is a typical cryptographic hash like SHA-256. Okay. So in an RSA accumulator, all of the values that go in the accumulator are prime numbers, because if they weren't primes, then you could accidentally get duplicates. Now whoever's adding these values to the accumulator still must check for duplicates, but they have to be prime numbers. So it's pretty easy to check if the number is not in there already, if it's a prime number. If it's not a prime number, it'll fail the test really fast. Okay? So whoever is creating or updating the accumulator takes the value and hashes it to a prime number. And then the witness in this case is the value of the accumulator with every other value that's in there except that one. So when you go to do a proof, let's say my number is 7. To compute my witness, I compute the accumulator with every other value in it except my 7. Okay? So now on slide 17, what I want to do is prove that if I exponentiate my witness to my private value 7, it should equal the accumulator value. And that's a fairly fast operation for the verifier. It can be a little slow for the prover in this case. That's why RSA accumulators aren't used very often. But how it works is the verifier picks a random generator that works in the set D and sends that to the prover. And then what the prover does is they should know what the witness is. That can be computed at any time as long as the accumulator hasn't changed. Anytime the accumulator changes, the prover has to update their witness. So on slide 17, this is what the prover has to do to prove that his value is in there without revealing his specific value. So you can see he computes a Z using that random generator that the verifier picked, prime number, and then takes all of those values, and the double bar in cryptography speak means byte concatenation. So take all the bytes of U, concatenate those with the accumulator value, concatenate all of those with Z, and concatenate all those by a prime number L. That's what that means. Okay, so we generate a fiat Shamir hash, which is X, which in zero knowledge proofs, that's used to do a non-interactive session. And then what you do is your value B, and you divide it by the prime number that you hashed to, and you also get the remainder. So that's what Q and R are. And basically what that means is if you multiply B by Q plus R, that should equal your original value. That should equal your original value. B or Q times L plus R is what it should be, would give you back your original value. And then the prover sends those values to the verifier, and then the verifier can do a quick check to make sure that it works out. So a lot of these next slides I'm going to walk you through pretty quickly, but I'm going to show you why it works, okay? So on slide 18, I've highlighted in blue what I'm going to touch next. And this is not something that the verifier does in that they substitute every single step. They just do the computation and do the quick check. But I'm showing you why it works here. So on slide 18, I've highlighted in blue the Q, because if you look on the left, I can substitute on slide 19 the value for Q there. And all I'm going to do is apply the rules that I discussed earlier. Okay? So moving to slide 20, you can see I basically took the L and I just did a distributive multiply in the exponents, because that's how the rule of exponents works. And then on slide 21, you see that there's a common base with the U and the D's. And so all I'm going to do is just move those next to each other in slide 22. Then on slide 23, because they're common bases, you can add the exponents. So that's what I've done. I remember what I said QL plus R was. That equals my original value. So I'm just going to substitute that on slide 24. And then on slide 25, I'm going to do something similar with the D's on the left-hand side there. I'm going to add the exponents. And then you can see that X is in both terms. So on slide 27, I take the X out, and then you see, oh, great, I have QL plus R. And that was B. So on slide 28, I just substitute the B back in. And then if you also look on the left, D to the B by itself is just Z. So on slide 29, I just highlighted what I'm about to touch. And then on slide 30, I substitute it. And so you have Z to the X instead of D to the BX. And then on slide 31, U to the B, remember I said U to the B, we want that to be equal to W, and that's what it should be. So if I substitute that in slide 32, you can see that you now get the same answer. So that's why the math works. Now, a verifier does not do that step by step. Like I said, they just do the computation once. Okay? So to do a set non-membership, you might ask, well, how does that work? Well, you just almost do the exact reverse. You're proving that the accumulator minus your value should equal your witness. And so why would I use RSA ever if it's a little slow? Well, RSA is nice because it actually allows you to have either a fixed set of elements or a dynamic set of elements. I've implemented both, and you can also create a public accumulator without doing a trusted setup, which is really nice. So if you need those properties, an RSA accumulator is not a bad way to go on slide 33. Now on slide 34, what about elliptic curves? So an elliptic curve basically uses an equation instead of doing straight modular arithmetic. And the advantage of that is you can shrink the size of your fields. In RSA, remember I said they had to be in the thousands of bits. Well, with elliptic curves, they can just be a few hundreds of bits. That's a big difference. So now on slide 35, you typically get what's called a predefined curve, which is they pick out some equation and they fill in what are called the coefficients, the curve modulus, the order, and the generator. And the big difference with an elliptic curve on slide 36 is that you now have scalars and points. So scalars are just the same thing that you saw in Diffie-Hellman and RSA, but we also have points, which have an X and a Y value. And in a lot of newer papers, they will typically lowercase scalars. So if you go read a math paper in cryptography and they are talking about a value, if it's lowercase, it's usually a scalar, but not always. And if it's uppercase, it's usually representing a point. And in the same equations apply. So if you look on 36, was it about fifth bullet point down? The uppercase ones are the points, and they do what's called multiplies. But to keep the same equation stuff, the cryptographers left it the same. So they call it exponentiating, but you don't exponentiate with elliptic curves. You multiply, and multiplies become adds. But it's the same type of equations, so that way they didn't have to modify it. But the same primitives still work. You can still do commitments. You can still do add bases and all of that stuff and combine exponents. So on slide 37, I'm going to add one new operation that elliptic curves can do. Not all elliptic curves can do this, but some can. And it's called a pairing. And in a pairing, you have what are called two generators in two different fields. And the pairing operation, which I'll denote with the lowercase letter E, allows you to So if you look at the second bullet point from the bottom on slide 37, you basically take two points with all of their exponents, and the pairing operation, you don't need to know how it cryptographically works, but mathematically what it does is it basically removes all of the exponents and multiplies them together on the outside. So it's commonly used only in the verification step when you're using a BLS curve, for example, or the BLS signature. You'll see this pairing operation, and just know it takes all the exponents and multiplies them together outside of it. And that's it. So on slide 38, why would you use a cryptographic accumulator? Well, it's smaller, it's faster. Many of them typically use a pairing-friendly curve. So the witnesses are smaller, the accumulators are smaller, but the one downside is you have to know all of the elements ahead of time, and it can't be a dynamic list. Otherwise, it won't work. So that's a little bummer. And because of that, you have a huge number of public parameters. So in Sovereign, for example, we have what's called a tails file, which is every possible value that could ever be in the accumulator. And so if you have 10 million items, this can get quite large. But like I said, everything else is smaller and faster, other than the public parameters are quite large. So now move to slide 39. The public parameters, besides the list of every possible value in it, is just a hash function, the name of the curve, and you have to have what's called a signature, because elliptic curves accumulate signatures, which are just points. And the great thing about points is you can just add them together to get the accumulator value, which is really nice. And then the witness is really easy to compute, because you don't have to do any modular arithmetic. You just add and subtract points. So it's really hard to figure out, but it still takes a long time to figure out if mine's in there or not, if you're an attacker. You'd still go through a law of computational power to find that out. Now on slide 40, I linked to a paper that shows all of the math behind it. I didn't want to copy and paste it in here because it is a lot to take in, which is why I'm not going to go through it here. But it makes lots of use of pairings and point addition and scalar multiplication, that kind of stuff. And I also included a link if you want to see the actual code in use in Hyperledger Indy, which is open source. But that's an example of an elliptic curve accumulator, and it's used for with verifiable credentials, which I'll explain near the end. So on slide 41, we have what's called a Merkle tree accumulator, which is really different than the other two, in that you have a Merkle tree. The values that are in the set are typically leaves, and then everything else is hashed all the way up. But the great thing, if I move to slide 42, is that Merkle trees are based on symmetric crypto instead of the other ones, which are asymmetric. So Merkle trees are quite fast, because all you need is a cryptographic hash function and to know how deep you're going, and what's the fan out? Are you doing binary, 4-ary, 8-ary, 16-ary, whatever you want to do to speed things up. And then the leaves can be whatever you need them to be. If you want them to be hashes, cryptographic commitments, points, scalars, whatever you want, you can put at the bottom, as long as you're consistent and you say this is what the leaf is. And then the witness is just the path to the root, which is really sweet, because you only have to make sure that that's correct. You don't care about anything else in the tree, just anything that affects your path to the root itself, and you only have to compute the root. But Merkle trees can get big if you're not careful and you want to use a lot of values. So on slide 43, in order to do these in zero knowledge, you need to use what's called a circuit-based approach. So there's two ways. There's a few ways to do that. You can do what's called a no trusted setup with bullet proofs, which is what we've implemented in Sovereign and Hyperledger Indy 2.0, or you could use Snarks, which are kind of new and improved system on Snarks. Snarks require a trusted setup. Snarks do not. Snarks are also post-quantum resistant. The only disadvantage to them is the proofs are massive. We're talking hundreds of kilobits for one proof. But Merkle trees can be dynamic or fixed, unlike elliptic curves, which can only be fixed. So, but they are similar to RSA ones just like that. So now let's get into how would I use an accumulator with a verifiable credential on slide 44. So you could basically say one claim or attribute in my verifiable credential represents a value that's in one of these sets or one of in the accumulator. And then you can use a proof, like I described earlier, to prove whether that value is in there or not, which works great for revocation because you're not leaking which value is yours in the set. You're just showing that your that attribute is not revoked or not. So you can think of like a credential ID that you would put in your verifiable credential, that something the issuer or whoever signed the credential puts in there to say, these are all the the credentials I have issued, and they're not revoked. And the signer or issuer maintains this set. And then whenever they need to revoke, they just remove the item from the set. And then whoever the credential holder is, when they go to create a proof that that value is in there, it won't show up because they'll say, is claim one or claim two or whatever the claim number is in that set? Nope, it's not. And so it must be revoked. So the only thing an observer would be able to see is which registry was checked. So if the issuer is maintaining a registry, the verifier is going to be able to see that, and so is the observer, but that's okay. If you had a revocation list that you were maintaining, they'd get to see that anyway. So the advantage is you get a little more enhanced privacy because if the bigger the set is, the more privacy you tend to get. We call that herd privacy. It's based on how many numbers are in the herd. So on slide 45, this doesn't have to be limited to just revocation. You can create any number of these accumulators for access control-based verification, right? My fifth claim in my verifiable credential says, do I have execution rights to this system or this remote system or read or write or whatever the case may be? And you could do any number of these control checks or on-demand registries, for example. A disaster happens, like a hurricane hits or tsunami, and you want to know, do I live in one of those affected regions? I can create one of these registries on the fly and add all the values that I know are in there, and then someone can prove that they live in one of those areas without leaking it if they want to do it that way, which is really cool. It's not limited to these, so the only limit is your imagination and what you can do with these in terms of set memberships. So that's all on slide 45. On slide 46, where are these actually being used in the wild? So Zcash, for example, their entire system is based on Merkle trees with Snarks. And I included a link to how they did their trusted setup because Snarks require trusted setup. And the Snark, what it does is two things. The first thing it checks is whether the transaction you're trying to use has been spent already and whether the signature that you sent is also valid. It's doing both of those in zero knowledge so that they can't even see which signature you sent. It's just that it's valid or not, and which transactions you sent. They're what they call shielded. And then they're done. And then Hyperledger Ursa, for example, with what's deemed the non-creds 1.0, actually has an elliptic curve-based accumulator that is used for non-revocation. There's an RSA-based one for what we call device provisioning. I want to be able to prove a device is authorized by me and not, you know, someone else. So there's some stuff that we were working out to prove that my laptop is an authorized device on my behalf or my phone, but not the school computer, for example. And then Hyperledger Ursa, what we're deeming a non-creds 2.0, I'm finishing up Merkle trees and using bulletproofs so we don't have to do a trusted setup. And with that, I'm done, and the floor is open to questions. And slide 48 is if you want any links to papers or publishings or anything like that on how to do cryptographic accumulators.
Thank you so much, Mike. And I'll lead in with some questions that I had, and everyone else, feel free to add yourself to the queue if you have questions as well. So I think the main thing that I'm still trying to think through is when the accumulator, when updates need to happen, basically. So, and I realize that how this works may differ depending on which approach you're using, but I'm curious to, like, if you can walk me through kind of how that happens. So, and I'll be specific about the things I was wondering. So, okay, so say what happens is you're using an accumulator to track, for which credentials have been revoked. And say you're using something like the credential ID that, you know, so a valid person would have, you know, they would have their information, including a witness that a verifier could take to say, yes, that's a valid credential. How does that usually happen? Is the issuer pushing witnesses, updated witnesses, to the valid holders, or are they competing? Because I'm also wondering if you were the one whose credential was revoked, you know, that makes a difference of whether you're being, you know, discovering at verification time, you know, just, oh, my witness didn't work, versus I can't even create a witness.
Yeah, so a credential issuer does not compute the witness. The holder does. So the issuer only cares about maintaining the list of revoked credentials or issued ones. So every time he wants to issue a credential, he would either add a value to it, and when he revokes, he would remove a value from the accumulator. So the only thing the issuer or the credential issuer is doing is updating the accumulator. That's it. Wherever he puts that, it could be on a blockchain, it could be in a database somewhere, it could be a URL, a CDN, doesn't matter where he puts it, as long as whoever has to check it knows where it is. So the credential issuer is the one who maintains the accumulator. A holder, when they go to present, since they know what their value is, they are the ones that can compute the witness. And what you don't want is to leak that witness out to somebody or your actual value, unless you don't care about privacy. In which case, why are you using cryptographic accumulators in the first place if you don't want the extra privacy? So the holder is the one who is checking to compute the witness. So there's some easy ways to do that. Like you could, he could maintain the witness that says this witness corresponds to this accumulator value. And then if the accumulator value ever changes, then they can look at it and go, well, what changed? Oh, this value was removed. Okay, I have to compute my new one. Or something was added, I have to add that to my witness. You know, like with a Merkle tree, I just have to update the hashes from my leaf to the root. And if nothing changed but the root, then great, I'm done, right? Does that answer your question?
Yes. Yeah, I think that does. I think the original problem I was worried about is if the issuer is needing to push it to the holders, then, that's kind of a chattier interface than I would like. So that has the properties that I was hoping it would. So that's great. No one else is on the queue, so I have another question, if that's okay. Feel free to add yourself to
sure.
the queue if you have any questions. But so I was curious, and maybe you can we can go back to some of the slides where you talked about this, but if you could walk us through, you know, so in the Hyperledger implementation, you mentioned how, you know, ECC, RSA, Merkle was chosen for different purposes, and you did talk about this as you went, but I was wondering if you could just walk us through what were the factors and why these different approaches were chosen, and I know you mentioned factors such as size, computational efficiency, things like that, but if you could just go through that, that might help us help some of the things gel a bit more.
Yeah. Okay. Well, at the time that Hyperledger Indy 1.0 was written, Snarks were so new that Merkle tree accumulators didn't really exist with the ability to do zero-knowledge proofs. So when we were creating it, we wanted to be able to do zero-knowledge proofs of set membership, which we couldn't do with Merkle trees at the time. And so that was 2016. And, you know, given blockchains, we didn't want the blockchain to be huge. And so we went with an elliptic curve-based approach so that the accumulator could be a lot smaller. Because remember, every time there's an update, you have to publish it somewhere. And since we were publishing the accumulator value to the blockchain, we didn't want to be publishing 2K or 4K accumulator values. Instead, we chose an elliptic curve-based one, which was only 256 bits per change, so much, much smaller. And it's faster to compute the proofs than RSA was. So that was the main reason. And what we did there is to save time on updating it. So there's two different ways you can do it, like I said, with the accumulator. You can add every time you issue and remove every time you revoke. So with Indy, we offered another approach, which says, let's just pre-issue a bunch of numbers in the accumulator. So if you wanted to be able to say, we're going to issue 10 million credentials eventually, then we just pre-put all of those values in the accumulator. And then whenever an issuer signed a credential, they just grabbed one of those numbers and gave it out, but they wouldn't have to update the accumulator, only when they revoked. So that was some efficiency gains that we made there. And then the reason we chose the RSA accumulator to do device provisioning was because devices are coming and going all the time. Think about how often you get a new phone or a new laptop or iPad or tablet or whatever the case may be. We couldn't possibly know how many of those there would be ahead of time. And we didn't want to have a fixed limit on how many of those would change. And so we went with an RSA-based accumulator so that we would have 2 to the 256 possible primes. I mean, think about how many primes that is. That's more atoms than there are in the universe, even though the universe might be constantly expanding. We have more than enough space to account for how big, how many devices we could have in there. The other thing that I didn't say that is the limit of Merkle trees is if you do, if you ever change the fan out or the depth, you have to modify your snark or your bulletproof equation to handle it. And the deeper you get, the slower they get, and RSA is a constant. So that was why we went with RSA over a Merkle tree at that time as well. So the reason we're going Merkle trees for Noncreds 2.0 was, one, it simplifies a lot of things that we were doing over the elliptic curve-based one, because now we can have we basically can issue more credentials, because the limit we were putting on the elliptic curve-based ones at the time was 10 million. And with Merkle trees, we could go all the way to 1 billion or 2 billion before we start hitting any performance issues. Like, we were able to say, are we able to check that a credential has been revoked in a set of 4 billion issued credentials, and we could do it in less than about a second with using bulletproofs and Merkle trees. So that was the reasons we went through it. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, that's perfect. Let me check the queue real fast, because we'll have more questions if no one else does. So, no one on the queue. So I was curious also, I would be interested to hear more context around, I think, slide 45, so different application. So, I guess I had been thinking largely about revocation as we went, but I was curious to hear more about some of these other possible use cases. So, it sounds like you could use it to say, well, basically, how do you say? I don't want to use the wrong term, but basically, the revocation would be like among a whole bunch of credentials, but you could use it, you know, within a credential, for example, in terms of access control. So like this one, checking any attribute in a set or not, could you walk us through an example of that a bit more?
Yeah, just think of it as a set check. You're checking whether an attribute or any number of attributes are in a set. And these sets are external to the credential itself, right? That's what a revocation registry is. So with like access controls, you could say attribute 3 corresponds to the labs I have access to and the government or as a student, right? So you could say attribute 3 says I'm allowed to access these labs or this lab, and it doesn't reveal which student accessed it per se, or which credential it came from. You might want to know which student, but maybe not the credential. You know, it just depends on your levels of privacy that you need. In some cases, it doesn't make sense. In some cases, it does. The one I see the most often is, like, I want to be able to prove I'm on the no-fly list whenever I get on a plane without leaking which credential is mine. Well, that list is constantly changing all the time, right? And it varies by country. So each country or state or province or territory can set up their own no-fly registry, and you can check it to see if one of your passport number, like so your U.S. passport number or Canadian or whatever, is that number in the no-fly list or not? And if the answer is no, then great, you're allowed on the plane. And those are independent of the credential issuer itself. Whereas revocation is largely controlled by who the credential issuer. So these are set memberships that can be anywhere. And the reason you would use an accumulator is usually because these lists are large. You can do zero knowledge proofs with small set checks, like 10 or less, without doing accumulators at all. But as soon as you get more than a few hundred entries, those proofs become very, very slow to compute. And the accumulator start to win out because, remember, like I said, it's very fast to verify and it's pretty quick to compute as well. So that's where
this is great.
Over. Yeah.
And Nate is on the queue. Nate, I'll scribe for you.
Sure, thanks. So I was just wondering, you made several references to being like in the revocation case where someone would remove a record from the accumulator. But we're often talking about these things, these accumulators are published to blockchains. Could you describe what it means in a blockchain scenario to remove a record from an accumulator set? Are you essentially just posting a new copy of the accumulator that no longer has it?
Correct. Yeah. So you say, so typically when you do a revocation check, you'd say it has to be the accumulator value as of 10 minutes ago or one day, you know, depends on how often the issuer updates. Most issuers of credentials will just maybe update once a day as a batch. So you basically, when you ask for a proof, the verifier would say, I need to be able to tell that your credential was not revoked as of 24 hours ago. Because every time I update or write a new value with yours removed or some value removed, right? It's a newer value. And yes, I do write the new value to the blockchain if that's how I choose to do it, which is how Hyperledger Indy does it. They just write the new value on there. And then, you know, also all transactions are typically timestamped. And so the verifier can say, I need it as of, you know, it's got to be within the last week or so or last 24 hours. And he can check that, right? Because if I submit him a proof and it doesn't go against that accumulator, it's going to fail.
Sounds good. So then it sounds like in the credential itself or whatever is being passed around, you need to have a good reference back to how to discover where the latest copy of that accumulator is, some sort of
that's right.
Transaction ID or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, you could use JSON-LD if you wanted to say this value is referenced here, for example. That's one way to do it. Or it could be on the blockchain itself. It could say, here's where the list of current values is kept, or here's where the accumulator value can be found, and it's a trustworthy source. And, you know, all that matters is that the verifier and the credential holder know how to go get those values so that they can do their checks.
Right. Thanks.
Okay.
That reminded me of a follow-up question. So let's see, I'm going back through. Oh, the interesting thing, you talked about time, which is very interesting. I like the idea that you mentioned, you know, it's not revoked within 24 hours ago. But one thing I'm wondering, did you ever have to deal with the scenario where people are saying, like, you know, not recent updates, like, say, they're curious if it was a credential that was valid, say, last year. Is that something that ever came up or that you?
Yeah. Yes, you can do that. And that's the great thing about blockchains is you can say, well, just go the accumulator value as of this time and date, and you can do a proof against that one and prove that it was valid then.
Great.
So,
and,
so any point in time.
Oh, sorry.
Yep.
Great.
Well, that's it. Yeah.
Juan is on the queue now. Juan?
I was going to ask a follow-up to Wayne's question. I was just wondering where all this fits into the work and anyone's working on how an Aries look up an emulator anywhere other than in.
Okay.
You're
I had a hard
out.
Time hearing.
Did you get that?
Something about
one,
like.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, something about does it have to be on the blockchain or who's updating? Anyway, maybe I misheard him. Maybe type it.
Okay, it looks like he's typing it now.
If anyone at Aries is working on it, yes, me. So.
How to look up other than Indie?
How to look up accumulators, as in, like, is there pre-written code that does this already? If you look at slide 48, there's at the very bottom, it's like cambrian.dev/accumulator docs. That's linked to some people that wrote some Rust code from Cambrian Technologies. So they wrote it in Rust, and they're not affiliated with Aries or Indie or Hyperledger at all. So there has been some work done with it outside of that community. I'm largely the one focusing on it in Indie and Aries.
Great. Well, I realize we're at time. And thank you. This was an amazing presentation, and I learned a lot today. So thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to Nate for the great scribing. I noticed lots of shout-outs in IRC for that. So thank you, and we'll see everyone next week.